Well, good evening. It's great to be here, and you can see, my family is able to be here, which is very nice. I feel much more at peace and complete now that they're here. So thanks for your prayers in that. When I was, I don't remember exactly how old I was, I think I was about 8 years old, approximately. I was part of an organization called the Cub Scouts. I don't know how many of you know the Cub Scouts, but it's the level below the Boy Scouts. I never actually made it to be a Boy Scout, but Cub Scout is very similar. So you have the uniforms and the hats and the badges and all that. You know what I'm talking about here, right? Okay. And part of being a Cub Scout, you have to do various activities and demonstrate proficiencies in tying knots and camping and outdoor type activities. And as you do these different activities, you get more and more points and badges. And if you do it well, eventually your whole chest is covered with these badges. One of the activities that we had to do, I grew up in Southern California, one of the activities we were supposed to do as Cub Scouts was demonstrate that we knew how to catch fish. So our scout leader took us one day to a lake right there in Southern California, and gave us a certain amount of time to go catch fish. And he gave us poles and the equipment. And so there we went, off to go try to catch fish. And so I stood by the edge of the shore. My parents are not fishermen. My dad never taught me how to fish, and so this was a bit of a brand new activity for me. And so I'm standing there trying to put bait on my hook and catch fish and do all the different things you're supposed to do, and wasn't catching anything. Half an hour goes by, hour goes by, and I look out the corner of my eye and I see my friends, same lake, they're catching fish. And I'm feeling more and more unsettled here because they're reeling in these fish, and I'm sitting here doing whatever I know how to do, and I'm catching absolutely nothing. Well, eventually a couple of hours goes by, and I remember our time was about to elapse, and it was starting to, the evening was coming upon us, and I had caught zero fish, not a single fish, despite my best efforts there. And I'm looking over at my fellow Cub Scouts, and they're doing very well with their buckets now full of fish. So I'm walking back, feeling somewhat sheepish, somewhat humiliated, and as I'm walking back along the shore of the lake to rejoin my friends, I see a dead fish right on the edge of the lake. You know how, like, sometimes you walk by on a lake and you'll see, like, these really old, nasty fish that they probably have some kind of disease, and long dead and kind of decaying. And I decided to take my fishing line and still had the hook on it, and I just put the hook right in that dead fish, and I put my fishing pole there, and I started to walk back triumphantly, pretending that I had caught this fish. I'm ashamed to say that I was very deceptive in that. I was trying to fit in and pretend like I had done as well as the other boys. I was a fake. I was a classic example of a fake fisherman. Totally fake. Had no business posing like a fisherman. Jesus calls all of us, doesn't he, to be fishers of men. He calls all of us to be fishers of men. That's part of what it is to be a disciple. Are you a fisher of men? Are you a fisher of people? Or are you a fake? Do you feel like a fake? Some of us know deep down that we're supposed to be able to do this. And we've heard of people doing it, maybe we've seen people do it, but like deep down in the core of our soul, we wonder, like, maybe I just don't have what it takes. Maybe I don't know what I'm doing. Maybe I'm a fake. We're feeling, some of us, a little bit like Peter, who fished all night but caught nothing. And we need to be taught by Jesus how to fish, where to fish, to be made a fisherman. So what I'm going to be talking about today is this question of being a fisherman, being a disciple, what that means. And I want to pose a question here. See, it's nice coming to a new group because I don't know a lot of you yet. And it's nice because I can ask these questions genuinely not knowing the answer to these questions. I can ask questions like, how many people here at Beacon of Light are successful fishermen. If I were to go around and poll people here and say, how many people have you brought into the kingdom that are walking with the Lord and doing well? How many people here are really exercising the gifts that God has given them? How many people here are just known for being prayer warriors and being passionate and just being bold and daring for the kingdom in different ways? I've done quite a bit of speaking in the Holmes County, Ohio area, and I was there with a very senior Beachy minister who some of you probably know. I won't mention his name. And he did a poll of his fellow ministers there, right in Holmes County, right? Holmes County is like Lancaster County. It's one of these places where they're real strongholds of Anabaptism. And he asked his fellow ministers, how many of us today can point to one person that we personally have brought into our congregations that are still walking with the Lord, that are part of our churches, that are doing well? Okay, these are ministers, right? These are not just ordinary people here. And he said, with great candor, with great humility, he says, not one person could raise their hand. Here he was in this round table of ministers there in Holmes County. And he said, if we're not doing it, wow, what does this say about the state of the church today? The Great Commission has become the Great Omission. And in fact, the vast majority of churches in plain settings, even in Protestant settings, certainly in Catholic settings, they struggle a lot with this question of being a successful fisherman. Broadly speaking, I'm going to make a generalization here, but broadly speaking, there are a few types of churches out there. So one type of church is more educational. And there's a strong emphasis on good teaching. It's kind of a classroom methodology. There are other, I'm going to give you four types of churches here. Another type of church is a more of a community service type church. I've been to these places where they emphasize working in soup kitchens, community service, picking up trash, that sort of thing. Then there are third types of churches that are more social, and they have a lot of events and kind of hang out with each other, but primarily their emphasis is on being social. And then fourth, there are churches that are more defensive, and the emphasis is on avoiding sin and on holding ground against the world. Okay? Educational, community service, social, and defensive. You find that in, like I said, all kinds of settings. Now, all four of those things are great things, right? Being educational, that's great. Being community service oriented, that's great. Being social, that's great. Being defensive, that's great. But the problem is, in each of these settings, is that often they lack this higher purpose, which I'm going to try to articulate here, which involves a true focus on the Great Commission. We know from Matthew 28, Jesus' final words that he says to his disciples after the resurrection, go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always to the end of the age. So we're going to talk a lot this evening about what this means. What does Jesus mean when he says to go and make disciples? How have we failed? How can we improve? That's the subject of this evening. Now, I'm from Boston, as most of you know, a church called Followers of the Way. And we've certainly made our share of mistakes along the way. And we've been growing at the same time. We've started just with a handful of people, and we grew to about 150 of us now in five congregations. And I will say that we often have these sessions where we look back and we ask, how did we make mistakes? How have we messed up over the years? And we've made so many mistakes, it pains me. And what we have said, and I think this is right, is that 90% of our problems have come from not proactively discipling. And that 90% of our success has come when we've identified individuals and we've very intentionally, strategically, proactively discipled them. Okay, so our greatest failures have come from a lack of discipleship, and our greatest success has come from when we've proactively done that. Now, I've been to hundreds of churches. I'm the son of a missionary. My father is a missionary in India, And we spent literally every weekend of my youth, we'd go to a different church. We'd go to a Presbyterian church and a Methodist church and a Baptist church and a Charismatic. I've been to hundreds, maybe even thousands of churches all over America. And I can say this with a high degree of confidence that in most places, you just kind of come and people hope that you figure it out somehow. Like, you just show up and they want you to come week after week, and the hope is that somehow, some way, you're going to get into maturity as a follower of Jesus. But there's not really a great, proactive, systematic, careful structure to get you from uninitiated to being mature. Which is very different than any other field, right? So, like, if you want to be a doctor, they're not just going to say, I hope you figure it out, right? They're going to put you through classes and tests and internships and resumes. It's very, very structured. So what I want us to do is open our Bibles to a passage here. Let's look at Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. We're going to read verses 11 to 13. I'm reading here from the New King James. Ephesians 4, 11 to 13. And he himself, he's talking about Jesus, gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Okay, I want you to look carefully here at this passage. It was very short. So it talks about Jesus giving these different positions, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, or shepherds, some translations say, and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Okay, so the first thing I want us to notice here is maybe I'll ask it as a question rather than tell you. Who here in Ephesians 4, in Paul's mind, is doing the ministry? The saints. Does everybody see this? And saints is just a generic term for Christian, right? It means holy one or holy person. Does everyone see that? In verse 12, it says that those first positions were given in verse 11 for the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry. Okay? Now, pretty much every church uses this terminology. I'm not faulting anybody for this because everyone does it. But I will say this, that our terminology is very bad here. If you go to most places and you say, who's your minister? They'll say, oh yeah, it's Emmanuel King or it's such and such, right? They'll list off the leaders. But Paul would strenuously object to that here because he would say that the people who are doing the work of the ministry are the saints, right? It's everybody who's supposed to be doing the work of the ministry. And the people who are the leaders are really more the equippers. They're the people who are facilitating the saints to do the work of the ministry. The best analogy here, it's a simple analogy. There's actually good Greek scholars who have proposed that we translate the Bible in this way, is that they would say that the best way to understand biblical church leaders is they're really more like coaches. So if you go watch any professional sport or college sport, you know, there's the basketball players or the football players, whoever they are, and they're definitely under direction, but the people who are doing the direction are the coaches, right? And the coaches aren't the ones who are playing the game. It's the players who are playing the game, and the coaches are equipping the players to play the game, right? And and so a lot of people, I think, have this mental model in their mind, which is not biblical, which is that, oh, it's our ministers who are the ones, that they're the ones that are supposed to be doing the work, and we just watch them do the work, and we kind of cheer them on. But in fact, it's actually the exact reverse in Paul's construct, where the leaders are really the coaches. Very important role. Hey, anybody who knows anything about sports knows how important it is to have good coaches, right? Coaches in the professional world, they make millions of dollars because they know how important it is to have good coaches here. But what I want all of us to do is to recognize that if you're thinking about the New Testament, the way that you should think about yourself is as a minister, as a frontline person who has a job, which is to do all the things that are talked about there in verse 12 and 13, to be ministers, right? To be evangelizing, to be serving, to be doing all these important tasks. Okay, I have a fear that, again, this is in churches everywhere, that what has happened as a result of this nomenclature, this terminology that we use, is that then what it is to be a part of a church, it gets reduced to kind of believing some facts, believing some truths. And I sometimes call it checklist Christianity, where in, so I was raised in Protestant evangelical settings where if you believe Jesus is the Son of God, check. Believe that he died on the cross for your sins, check. He was raised from the dead, check. He's going to come again, check. All set. You're a Christian. Good. Good to go. You're great. And all those things are true, and I certainly hope that all of us believe all those things. They're all very important. But there's a lot more to being a Christian than just believing these facts, right? It's about being an active discipler, disciple maker, fisher of men, fisher of people. Now, the checklists vary in different settings. It's definitely different in plain settings. There's emphasis on other very important truths, non-resistance, divorce and remarriage, separation from the world, head covering, things like that. All good. All very important. I've strongly argued for all those things in my writings and in my sermons. But this is not the end goal, right? These are steps towards a greater goal. And what we have to do is, some people, I think, fall into this mentality, okay, I'm not fighting in war, I'm not a police officer, I'm not watching TV, I'm not dressing immodestly, you know, check, 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 I'm good, right? It's a different type of checklist we can fall into that's, again, all important things, but we have to be very careful. The goal of our Christian life is not just to not sin, right? Isn't that like such a low bar, right? Like, the goal of my life is not to, hey, that's a great thing. What if you met somebody who said, the goal of my life is not to fall down when I walk? That's the goal of my life. I just want to walk around and not fall down. You would say, yeah, that's fine. I don't want to fall down either. But I could understand if somebody said, my goal is to climb Mount Everest or to learn a foreign language or to build some great company or go be a missionary somewhere. I could understand those things because those are positive, compelling visions. So what I want us to do is to start to think about discipleship in a much more positive way, not just avoiding things, not just having a checklist, but having a positive vision. And as we're going to see shortly, discipleship is not just sitting in the pews. It's not just being a nice person. It's not just going to meetings. It's about transformation. It's about seeing ourselves transformed, the people around us transformed, and living beautiful, inspiring lives of following Jesus. Now, I generally have also been disappointed that secular organizations have taken on the role that the church should have played. So, for example, if someone says, I'm an alcoholic, what am I going to do? Well, so many people will say, oh yeah, go to Alcoholics Anonymous down the street, and they're going to be able to help you with your problem. Or someone says, oh, I've got an anger problem. They're going to say, oh yeah, call this psychologist down the road, and they're going to help you with your anger. Or I'm addicted to drugs. Okay, go to this clinic over here. Or I've got a bad marriage. Oh, okay, here's a marriage counselor over here. What people should say, if we were doing our jobs right, what they should say is they should say, you know what? You should get to be part of the church. Because the church is where your whole life can be transformed. People should think, wow, the church is the place where if you want to get your whole life right, whether it's off of pornography, a good marriage, whether it's someone who wants to lose weight, whatever it is, they should say, this is the place to go because the power of God is in their midst and people's lives are transformed. That should be our reputation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you, in tonight's session, I'm going to give you 5 points on how to make this a reality. I've just kind of set the stage here about how we're in this, we're in a little bit of a hole. I hope you feel some of this hole that we're in, where a lot of us kind of look around and we're not necessarily doing that great of a job at being fishermen. We're maybe in a rut, and we're wanting to be positively embracing discipleship that Jesus calls us to. All right, so here's the first point. Number one, embrace that discipleship is the main vocation in your life. Embrace that discipleship is the main vocation in your life. The author Mark Twain, who of course wrote in the 1800s, said it very well. He said, the two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. Those are the two most important days of your life. The day you were born and the day you find out why. Now, if you don't know why you were born, I'm going to tell you. This is going to be the one of the two most important days of your life. Today's the 18th, right? January 18th, 2020. I'm going to tell you the reason that you are put on this earth. You ready? All right. You were put here on this earth. Every man, every woman, every child was put here on this earth to disciple people. That's your purpose. In Genesis 1, the very first command that's given in the whole Bible, what's the very first command? The whole Bible. Yeah, be fruitful and multiply. It's the very first command. And what Jesus does in Matthew is he transforms that from fill the earth with people to fill the earth with disciples. It's the same basic command, same basic essence. And in fact, one of the things that we do when those of us who have children is that we are helping to fill the world with agents of God's dominion. When we're having children, and it's good to have lots of children, because it's a way that we fulfill God's command to subdue the earth and take dominion over it. Okay, so every man, every woman, every child here, this is the reason you were put on this earth, to make disciples. There it is. To make disciples of yourself, certainly. If you are a stay-at-home mother, I can't think of a vocation that more perfectly can be described as being a disciple maker. I can't, right? Someone who has got this full-time vocation of taking these little lives and shaping them to be men and women of God as they grow up. What an amazing vocation that is. It's shaping people. There's a lot of bad theology out there. You know, there's a lot of hymns that sometimes I kind of cringe at, that say something like, I'm going to come to you, God, one day, and I'm only going to cling to the cross, and I have nothing else, and that sort of thing. A lot of bad Protestant theology there. There's a verse, it's one of the verses that is, I count it as one of my life verses, where it's Paul speaking, and he says, for what is our hope, or joy, or crown of boasting? What's the answer to that? It's 1 Thessalonians 2. For what is our hope, or joy, or crown of boasting? It's very interesting. If you don't know the verse, well, how would you answer that? What is our hope? What is our joy? What is our crown of boasting? How does Paul answer that? What's that? No, he doesn't say that. He says in 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 to 20, what? Yeah. Is it not indeed you, Thessalonians, before our Lord Jesus at his coming? For you are our glory and joy. So what Paul's saying is that you, Thessalonians, are my hope, my joy, my crown of boasting when Jesus appears. Wow. That's pretty strong theology, isn't it? And I often wonder, for many of us who one day stand before God, all of us will one day stand before God, what will we have as our hope or joy or crown of boasting? Will there be anything? For Paul, he clearly said it was these people that he had discipled, these people that he had poured into. So we have to ask the question, what is discipleship? Now, I'm going to make it super simple. I like making things as simple as possible. The verse that I think best describes discipleship is simply what Jesus said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men, right? That's a great verse to summarize discipleship. Follow me, so you follow Jesus, you do the things that he does, and I will make you. So there's a transformation that Jesus is doing. This isn't just something that happens automatically. Jesus actively is changing someone to be fishers of men or fishers of people. Now, for so many people, when they think of discipleship, they'll think of a class. They'll think of like, oh yeah, there's a discipleship class. We go to that every other Thursday at 7:30 for an hour. That's our discipleship experience. Well, in fact, if you look at how Jesus did it, he spent 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with his crew there, right? His disciples. They ate together, they prayed together, they went to the market together, they went to the synagogue together, they did everything together. And how long did it take Jesus to finish his discipleship with his disciples? Yeah, it was 3 years. It was a little bit over 3 years. So this is the perfect Son of God, no sin, who's 24/7 with his group of 12, and it takes him 3 years to do that. I think it's a joke that we would even call a class every other Thursday for 6 weeks anything like discipleship, when here we are flawed with way less time, that we would think that's even beginning to come close to what Jesus describes. For Jesus, discipleship was intensive companionship. He was with them all the time. He spent so much time with them. That's the first component of discipleship, intensive companionship. The second one is teaching, and the third is testing. Intensive companionship, teaching, and testing. Those are the three elements. And so he doesn't just spend time with them. He also teaches them formally. He gives them very structured thoughts and ideas. The Sermon on the Mount is, of course, one, but there's many others. And then he tests them. Can someone think of some examples of how he tests his disciples? Yeah. He sent them out on these campaigns, remember? They're very practical tests, and he wanted them to go out and then report back. Hey, how'd it go? And they had some things right, some things wrong. This was how Jesus did it. So it's intensive companionship, teaching and testing for the purpose of transforming people to be followers of Jesus. Okay? That's our working definition of discipleship here. Intensive companionship, teaching and testing for the purpose of transforming people into followers of Jesus. Now, the needs are like off the chart. Okay, like just ridiculously off the chart. I mean, even, I've never been to any church, including ours, where there's not massive, massive needs when you get to know people about just the things going on in their lives, the hurts, the burdens they carry, massive problems. And one of the worst things you can do, I remember, so my wife who's here, we were learning how to be parents. And we just had one at the time. We have seven now. We had one, and my wife was expecting twins. We have identical twin boys. We're both here. And we pretty quickly realized that we were in over our head. It's funny. You think you know everything about parenting before you're a parent, right? And then once you actually start having children, you're like, whoa, I'm like, I don't really know what I'm doing. And so we realized that we needed to grow and learn. And there was a Mennonite church near us, about an hour away, and they were doing well. I still think they did an excellent job of modeling great parenting. And so we decided to sell our place. We literally sold our place. It was the first place I ever owned, and moved a pretty long distance. I had to commute each way, Monday through Friday, an hour and a half, so 3 hours of commute every day, just so I could go be out at this particular church and be taught on child rearing. I really wanted to get this right, because I knew enough to know that those years go fast. And often, I would go ask people, I'd say, okay, we're here. I want to know now. Tell me, how do we do this? What is this like? The most common answer I would get, just mind the Lord. Just mind the Lord. Like, just mind the Lord. I sold everything to come out here. I want more. Give me some more substance than just mind the Lord. I want some real specific teaching, some testing, some lessons. I want to watch you. I want to know what this is like. There are so many times that people will say, I fell into pornography this week. I'll pray for you. Okay, like I almost think that's like, okay, great, you should pray for people for sure. But if that's the level of help that you're giving to people, that's just not good, right? That's just such a poor answer. That insufficient answer, I should say. you're not doing near enough as what you should be doing. And then just these kind of vague platitudes, you know, mind the Lord or I'll pray for you or something like that. And definitely don't say to people, oh, just try harder, right? Like, this is just bad form, right? What we are supposed to be all about is helping people, giving them structures and tools and ideas and mentorship and someone who's going to just put their arm around you and walk you through the whole adventure of what it is to be a Christian. Okay? All right, so that was my first point. I got four to go here. So my first point was embrace that discipleship is the main vocation of your life. All right, second point here is that loving and grateful relationships are the channel of discipleship. Loving and grateful relationships are the channel of discipleship. Now, if I were to ask you a question to make a list of the people who have made the biggest impact in your life, and you had to get out a little paper and spend 2 minutes and just jot out who are the people who have made the biggest impact in your life, almost certainly, I think you would write down people who have spent a lot of time with you, they've initiated with you, they've invested time in your life, and I've consistently noted that the people who are usually at the top of that list are often some of the most caring and warm people. Right? It's very rare that like sour, stiff, grumpy people are effective at influencing others. Okay? So, common sense, right? I'm not saying anything that revolutionary here. That it's loving people, it's warm, it's people who are initiating, pouring in. Those are the ones who typically make the biggest impact in your life. I was at a homeschool conference a couple years ago, and we love to read as a family, and there was a particular bookseller that we were in the booth of there, and I was walking around looking at the books. My children were looking at some of the books, and there was a little sign right above the book area that I just loved. I don't think I'll ever forget this. The sign said, "No app can substitute for your lap." I love that. No app can substitute for your lap. And I thought, that is brilliant. No app. There's nothing that can substitute for taking your child, putting them in your lap, and just spending lots and lots of time with them to connect with them in your lap as you read to them. Right? You can't just give them a video screen or something like that and pretend that that's going to build a relationship. I love the line in Mark where it says that Jesus looked at him and loved him. Remember that? Ah, oh, I love that. I wish I could have seen that look. Jesus looked at him and loved him. How amazing would that be to see Jesus gazing down at this rich young ruler, looking at him and loving him. So how is it with you? How have you done with taking initiative at face-to-face time, at being warm, at investing in other people's lives? How many people here have heard the name Praying Hyde or John Hyde? Anybody know who he is? A couple people do. All right. Not a lot. If you haven't read his biography, you should totally read his biography. It's very well done. He was a person who lived around the turn of the 20th century, and he was a missionary to India. Actually, I'll give you just a one-minute version about him before I read this story from his life. So inspiring. I think one of the most inspiring people of the last 150 years. He went to India and was having great difficulties. He went as a missionary, converting anybody. And here he was hitting just a wall and not being effective at all. And he would try and try and try. Was having no success in evangelism there. And eventually, one day he said, "God, I am so desperate that if you don't give me converts here, if you don't give me disciples here, I feel like I'm going to die." And so he began to pray, "Lord, give me disciples or I die." And then finally he got up at one conference and he said, "I'm going to pray." It must have been God giving him some moment of holy boldness here, but he got up and said, "I'm going to pray that this year I lead successfully to the Lord one person per day." Per day, right? And he was living in an area of India that's mostly Hindus, a few Muslims. These are not easy conversions at all. And I think a lot of people thought he was out of his mind, but he began to pray like you won't believe for hours a day. And lo and behold, that year he had sometimes more than one convert per day for the entire year. And the descriptions of people praying with him, being in the same room with him, even when he prayed, they said consistently that it felt like heaven would just pour down onto the earth. All right, so I'll tell you a little story of Praying Hyde here. So he was a man who, as I said, was a great prayer warrior. And early on, he came across an Indian man who was an evangelist. And Praying Hyde thought, or his full name is John Hyde, his real name is John Hyde. H-Y-D-E is his last name. Not H-I-D-E, H-Y-D-E. And he meets this Indian man who's an evangelist, and he thinks he's kind of a cold person, kind of ineffective. And he begins to pray, and he says, "Lord, you know how cold such and such a brother is." And right then, he felt the Holy Spirit stop him, and with this verse, Proverbs chapter 30, verse 10, "Don't accuse God's servant to his master." And so Praying Hyde changed his approach, and he began to think of everything good in this person's life and began to thank God for him. And he just began to pray, "God, I thank you for this brother, for this attribute and this attribute." And interestingly, within a short time, that man became outstandingly successful as an evangelist. Very interesting, isn't it? What a different approach, rather than being accusatory, than to be just thankful and grateful for a person's life. In our home, you will often hear us this line. We will hear 1, 2, 3. So what's meant by that? 1, 2, 3. If you can remember this, it's very powerful. It'll help your homes as well. It comes from James chapter 1, verses 2 to 3. James chapter 1, verses 2 to 3 says, "Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance." And so anytime somebody looks grumpy or has a bad attitude or anything like that, 1, 2, 3 it. James chapter 1, verse 2, 3, right? There is no reason why Christians should not be joyful and finding joy in the most difficult of circumstances. How are we known to each other in this way, right? As joyful people, "Wow, I'm so glad to see you. I'm so thankful to see you here." And people can sense and feel when that comes from your heart. All right, point number 3. Begin your journey of discipleship with the practice of confession. Begin your journey of discipleship with the practice of confession. You are only as sick as your deepest secret. You're only as sick as your deepest secret. That's one of the powerful principles in our spiritual lives. The reality, though, is that for most of us, we can probably confess 98% of the stuff in our life, the problems in our life. But there's like this 2% that is there, and it's a different 2% for everybody, that would be very, very difficult for you to confess. It would be really hard. And that 2% of what you struggle to confess is going to be what ruins you. What we don't realize is that the reason we don't confess is pride, right? If we're really honest, we would just say, like, it's pride. I'd be the first to say that's what's made it difficult for me to confess. And we know that pride is consistently described in the Bible as the worst sin. Consistently described as the worst sin. A lot of times you'll hear this line, and there's some truth to this, but it's actually much worse. They'll say, "Oh, you have three enemies. Your three enemies are the world, the flesh, and the devil." How many people have heard that? You have three enemies, right? The world, the flesh, and the devil. In fact, it's actually way worse than that. Because it says that in the book of 1 Peter as well as in James, it says, "God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble." So what this means is that if you are a proud person, you actually have a fourth enemy. Who's that fourth enemy? God. God opposes the proud. Wow. Like, hey, having the world, the flesh, and the devil, like, that's bad enough for me. To have God as my enemy, forget of it. Forget about it. Lights out, right? Like, what chance do any of us have? This is why confession is so important, because this is one of the primary ways, if not the primary way, that you can just break down your pride and take that 2% and just just lay it out there, right? That last 2% of whatever's in your heart. One of the things that we do in Boston a lot is we spend a lot of our time working together in mostly small groups and just confessing and getting good at confessing the things in our lives. It's very easy in the modern American world to kind of skate along, and you sit in meetings and you look nice and you go home and come back to another meeting and you've got those some pretty big issues in your heart that you're not laying out before some fellow believers there. We ask people to be very open about that, to be vulnerable in that. I'll read you a list of some of the things that different people have confessed. I'm not going to put any names on these things. Some people have said lack of boldness. Another person, I tell white lies. Another person, I'm judgmental. Another person, I'm overweight and I want to lose 50 pounds. Another person, myself, discipline is poor. Another person, my prayer life is irregular and weak. Another person is, I'm bad at holding conversations. Another person, I have a complaining spirit. Another person, my children are out of control. Another person is, I sin regularly with lust. Another person is, I have a cynical spirit. I fall into depression. Another person, I'm insecure. Another person, I have a lack of passion. Another person, I'm impatient. Another person, I struggle to be engaged. Another person said, my children have lost interest in spiritual matters. Another person, my fasting is almost non-existent. Another person says, I know I'm not approachable. Another person is, I struggle watching too much worldly entertainment. Another person is, I haven't done evangelism in a long time. Another person, I waste time all the time on social media. Another person, I have outbursts of anger. It's a lot of sins there, right? And to be able to lay that out in front of a group of people, a small group of people, is huge, huge. What is the promise that's given in James? Confess your sins or your transgressions to one another? That you may be healed. Oh, I love that, right? The beginning of healing comes from confession, being able to just lay it out and confess there. But so often we're too cool, we're too busy, we care about how we look and projecting a certain image way more than we should, and we miss the healing power of confession. Okay, point number four, to grow in the ministry of admonishment. Grow in the ministry of admonishment. A lot of people hear me say this a lot, but I want to repeat this. So this is one of the dominant commands of the Bible. Now, you probably heard when you were a child from your mother, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, right? I heard that. Probably most of us said that. Now, that's actually a good rule. If you're 10 years old or less, that's a good rule. You should probably keep that rule. But if you're an adult, that just doesn't work. It's not biblical at all. I'm going to read you a few verses from the Bible just to illustrate how dominant this teaching is of admonishment in the Bible. I'm going to read some from the Old, some from the New Testament. In Leviticus 19:17, it says, "You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him." Very interesting. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. So it's saying, like, if you don't go and rebuke your neighbor, you're like bearing sin and you're expressing hatred towards your brother. I have a lot of examples. I'm not going to read most of these. One of the major themes of the book of Proverbs is that if you are a wise person, you will love a rebuke, but if you're a fool, you hate it. Let's read you a couple of verses. "Do not correct a scoffer, lest he hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you." That's Proverbs 9:8. Proverbs 15:21. Or actually, I'll read this one. I'll skip that one. Proverbs 27:6. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." Here's David. Psalm 141:5. I like this one. "Let the righteous strike me, it shall be a kindness, and let him rebuke me, it shall be as excellent oil. Let my head not refuse it." So David's praying there. He's saying, "God, please let a righteous person strike me. It shall be kindness. Let him rebuke me, it will be as excellent oil. Let my head not refuse it." When's the last time somebody here prayed God, please let somebody rebuke me. Let some righteous person come rebuke me. Right? Is this like part of your repertoire of regular prayers? For most of us, it's not, right? Like, we don't really want to be rebuked. But this is what David prayed regularly. Like, God, I want to be rebuked. I want a righteous person to come strike me. It shall be a kindness. That's Psalm 141, verse 5. I'm just going to do a flyby of a bunch of passages. I have, like, over 30 verses here. This is Paul speaking, summarizing his ministry at Ephesus, which is the city that he spent the most time on in his missionary journey. It says, "Be on the alert, remembering that for night and day, for a period of 3 years, I did not cease to admonish each one with tears." That's how he describes his ministry at Ephesus. "For 3 years, I didn't stop to admonish each one with tears." 1 Corinthians 4:14, "I did not write these things to shame you, but to admonish you as my beloved children." Romans 15:14, "Concerning you, brethren, I myself am convinced that you are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able to admonish one another." Colossians 1:28, "Him we proclaim, admonishing every man and teaching every man with all wisdom, that we may present every man complete in Christ." Colossians 3:16, "Let the word of Christ richly dwell within you with all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing with thankfulness in your heart." "And we urge you, brothers," this is 1 Thessalonians 5:14, "admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all." I've got so many here. I'll do a couple more. Of course, Matthew 18 is a famous one. "When your brother sins, go reprove him in private." Oh, here's one. 2 Timothy 4:2. "Preach the word, be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction." So reprove, rebuke there. What about young people? It even says to young people, "These things exhort, speak, and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you." One of the marks of a healthy group is the gap from when someone sees a problem from when they speak that problem and address it directly. So if you have an unhealthy group, there's a big lag time from when someone sees a problem to when it's discussed and addressed. If you have a healthy group, it's a very narrow time. I was at the Perizzos for lunch today, and I was telling TR and a couple of others about, I have this fascination, I've had this multi-year fascination with groups that have successfully reformed the hardest of prisoners, and people have been in and out of prisons for like decades. And I've read their books, I study them. I actually, this past summer, I went and visited a rehab center in Utah that has the highest success rate at reforming people who are, in this case, drug addicts and drug dealers. And it was fascinating. What they do is, at this particular place, and most of the residents said this was the single most powerful thing that they did for change there, twice a week, they get everybody in a room, they call it the games, and they have people confront everyone else with any issues that they saw in that person over the week, right? And they just they get them to talk it out and hash it out. And consistently, what these prisoners said, the ex-prisoners said, was, "If it weren't for that, how would we ever get better as humans? How would we ever get better as people?" Right? And it's amazing to watch people who before would fix things with punches or blows, and just sit there in a room and learn to talk it out and admonish each other. Now, I think that most churches, we're just too polite. Way too polite. Like, the thought of doing that is, like, unimaginable, right? And, hey, being polite has a time and a place, no doubt. But are we potentially failing one another for not having grown in the ministry of admonishment? Now, it's a two-way street. You got to want it. You got to pray for it. You got to confess as well. But it's a really important model here. Okay. Fifth and final point. Discipleship is a costly endeavor. Discipleship is a costly endeavor. Okay. This is a point that we need to dwell on here. It's very easy. It's so easy. And this, in fact, I think that one of the greatest dangers for the church in America is that we fall into the kind of the American dream, right? You have, everybody has their nice house. They live a comfortable life. They come together for meetings. You can kind of live a pretty good life here and be a practicing Christian in good standing with the church and not really have to pay that much of a cost, right? And I really get worried. And frankly, I get the most worried whenever, my wife hears this all the time, whenever I go to Lancaster County or Holmes County, I'm like the most panicked about it because it's just like people are just so comfortable. And these multi-generational, multi-million dollar businesses, and it doesn't feel like anybody's an alien or a stranger. Everyone's just doing fine. And it's really difficult in those settings to get people to just be passionate for the kingdom. When you look at what Jesus said, he was very concerned about people following him superficially and for the wrong reasons. You remember what he said, that famous passage in Luke 14, how it begins and ends. He comes first and he notices there's a big crowd of people, and it's like he gets nervous. He turns around and he says, if anyone comes after me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And he tells those two stories about counting the cost. We know those stories about building a tower and going out to war. And how does he end? Anybody remember how he ends that section? He ends with a line, a really powerful line that kind of ends, that brackets that section. He says, unless someone gives up, it's close. Unless someone gives up everything he has, he cannot be my disciple. Okay, so he ends that section by saying, just to kind of hammer the point home yet another way, if you don't give up everything, can't be my disciple. I love reading the stories of the early Anabaptists and the Martyr's Mirror. You know, wow, you read these stories. I mean, who can't be inspired by these, right? You read these stories and you think, like, these are people who gave it up. They gave up everything. They gave their all. They were completely sold out for the Lord. Materialism, comfort is the last words that you would use about that group. And then you look at, again, you go drive around Lancaster County, Holmes County, and you think, these are the descendants of the people in the Martyr's Mirror. It's like, what happened here? What happened to that I'm just going to be a person who's willing to die, to lay down everything for the sake of the gospel? The New Testament church in the book of Acts is pictured as this on-the-move, struggling, passionate church. I spend a fair bit of time, as I mentioned last night, traveling abroad, and I was in Uganda, I think 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, and I go to East Africa near the end of every year. I've done that for 5 years now, and East Africa is a fascinating area for what is brewing there, particularly in areas like Kenya and Somalia. And I'm going to read you a true story here as we close. And I want you to use this as a way to just help us calibrate how we are doing with respect to Luke 14 and our level of sacrifice. Right? It's very, very easy to not even try to fish, to just be, like I said, you drive into your driveway, you pull into your garage, you live your life, and you're not exerting yourself in any meaningful way at all. Very easy to do that for months, years even. And I worry about that dilemma. All right, so this is a true story that happened in Somalia, and it's about a man whose name is Musa, M-U-S-A, Musa. This man Musa was a husband to a woman named Halima, and he was a father of three boys. The oldest boy's name was Omar, who was 12 years old, Ali, who was 11, and Salat, who was 7 years old. Musa was a follower of Jesus, and he was also a leader of a house church. And he was a very noble, honorable man who served there in that church. But he strongly believed that part of what it was to be a follower of Jesus was to relentlessly, boldly, proclaim the gospel in East Africa. So what he would do is every day he would go for a walk, and he would just walk into the downtown, or the village there, not downtown, into the village, and he would engage in these conversations with people and hope that someone would hear him talk and go deeper, want to go deeper into what he would call Jesus talk. And he noticed that consistently when he went into the village and mingled with the locals there, that there was a woman who was very consistently showing up. She wouldn't come too close, and as they do in Somalia, her face was mostly covered, but her ears were obviously taking in every word that he spoke. Like most Somali women, she'd been tattooed with henna. Henna is a type of tattoo that's on the hands and on the arms. And her arms and part of her face were covered with these intricate designs. Musa knew that this woman was married to a high-ranking leader in an organization called Al-Shabaab. Some of you know Al-Shabaab. It's an Islamic extremist group that is very active in Somalia. And so Musa one day told his friend Ahmed, he said, "My prayer is that I will have the opportunity to lead her to Christ." Ahmed pursed his lips and shook his head. "Musa, you are my friend, and I honor you for loving God as you do and for sharing your faith so freely, but you are playing with fire. You know who her husband is." Musa replied, "Yes, I know. And I also know that God's word tells us to preach the gospel to all nations, including ours. And I don't see any exceptions." Ahmed said, "But you could put your family in danger. You could put yourself in danger." Musa said, "If nobody dares to share Christ with her, then her life, in eternal terms, is in more danger." Musa said, "We are not responsible for outcomes, but we are responsible for sharing. Even if it means being put in danger or even getting killed." Musa said, "Yes, even if it means such danger. But your family," Musa put up his hand, "Ahmed, God is bigger than my family. I love my wife, I love my children, but we are told in the Bible to love Christ above all." That night, Musa and his wife prayed for that Muslim woman. The next day, when Musa struck up conversations in the marketplace, the woman came closer. Musa nodded a greeting to her and then said, "Each day I see you here. Your eyes are inquisitive about this God of whom I speak. Your ears are listening." She nodded. "I have a gift for you," he said, glancing left and then right. Her eyes widened. She looked down and saw him slip a small, dark book out from a bag. It was a Bible. She glanced furtively from side to side. "Thank you," she whispered. "Thank you so much." Then she left. A week later, she told Musa that she had found a place in her heart for the Christ of the Bible. "I am committed to following him," she declared, "not Allah." Musa beamed, not as a reflection of pride in himself, but in honor to God. The next week, however, the woman did not show up, nor the following week. Musa became worried. Finally, the woman came, but this time her head was bowed. Her eyes were less inquisitive, and the left side of her face was purplish with bruising. Her husband had noticed a change in her and asked her why. She told him about her conversion to Christ, and he beat her. A few days later, a group of Muslim men, henchmen of the woman's husband, showed up at Musa's house and began screaming at him for converting the woman. They demanded that Musa tell them where an influential Christian leader named Mabwera could be found. Musa had never heard of him. "We will give you 2 days," the militant leader said. "Have Mabwera here when we return, or else." When the men left, Musa's wife insisted that he leave Somalia. Reluctantly, he traveled to a refugee camp in Kenya. 2 days later, when Halima was making lunch for herself and the boys, the henchmen arrived at Musa's home. When they discovered that he had left, the two men grabbed Omar and Ali, if you remember those were his sons, tied their feet together and blindfolded them. Somehow, Halima, that's his wife, and Salat, the youngest boy, escaped and eventually reconnected with Musa in Kenya. But their two older sons would pay the price for what the killers called the sins of their father. They were beheaded. True story. So I give you the story here to remind us of just a small taste of the cost of what it is to be a follower of Jesus in ways that we would all say are admirable. Now the question is, as you look at your own life, the past week, the past month, the past year, what kind of sacrifice would we say you have offered, particularly in light of what Jesus said in Luke 14? Have you given up everything that you have had to follow him? Or is your life one of comfort, of ease, of pleasing others? Are you even distressed at a potential lack of fish that you have caught? Have you embraced the true cost of discipleship, which indeed is everything that you have, your whole life? As I said, it's very easy for us to skate in this life, way too easy, and to forget that the charge of our lives is to make disciples of all nations. Let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, I pray for everyone here that you would help us not to be complacent. The devil specializes in helping us to be complacent people who are seduced by materialism, by comfort, by ease, by entertainment, not remembering that our lives are like a vapor, here today, gone tomorrow, and that we will all stand before the judgment seat, and that we will all have to answer the question, what is our hope, what is our joy, what is our crown of boasting? May we not be without boast. May we not be without a group of people that we could point to as those that we have poured into and sacrificed greatly. I know that there are people in this room that are zealous to make disciples, that are zealous to be skilled fishers of men and women. For those who do not have that, who are lukewarm, who are apathetic, I pray that you would stir us up while it is too late. Well, before it is too late, and that we may be able to stand before you one day and be able to have a line that Jesus had, behold, here am I and the children that you've given me. May we be able to make that statement with boldness and with confidence. I pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.